I'm Lou Smith. I'm the Lutheran pastor at the State University at Wisconsin. He's almost retreated 7 years at the University of Wisconsin in Eau Claire. And the topic of this session and the session that goes tomorrow as complement to it, I've labeled Karl Marx and his significance for Christians. Now, I guess what I want to say, first of all, is that one, the talk part of today will be longer than the talk part of tomorrow, for the simple reason that what I want to do today is to try to lay out some kinds of basic categories that I think are useful in understanding what Marx was about, and then tomorrow pick up the second half of that and say, here are some items that I think Christians need to pay attention to in terms of what Marx has had to say. So in one sense, I was pretty conscious in my own mind that this is a kind of an incomplete affair today, and I hope you'll bear with me on that. The reason that I want to pay attention in the first place to Marx is that I think that for most North American and probably most North Atlantic Christians, Marx is something of a boogeyman, the father of a totalitarian system that's bent on destroying our economic and democratic liberties on the one hand, and on the other hand, the father of materialistic atheism that's bent on destroying our faith and the faith of our children and everything else. And I'd like to try to, not uncritically, but critically dispel that image, and I guess for four reasons. First of all, because I don't think we help ourselves or other people by perpetuating falsehoods, even if they're comfortable falsehoods for us. Second reason is that there are just simply many members of the human family who now live in societies that have been consciously influenced by Marx's understanding of things, even if those Marxist concepts have been mediated by other people, like Lenin in the case of the Soviet system, Mao in the case of China, and so on. Nevertheless, there's a basic Marx rootage in the determining of life for a lot of our human brothers and sisters. And then thirdly, the fact is that many of our baptized brothers and sisters throughout the world, especially many of them at the crunch point of life and death struggles, have found Marx to be helpful to them in understanding their situation. And then the fourth item is just simply that if that's so, maybe it is that Marx can help us as North American Christians to understand our situation. So that's my rationale. Let me give you a very little bit of biographical data just to say something about Marx the man. He was born in 1818 in Trier in Germany. He was culturally German, he was ethnically Jewish, and he was religiously Lutheran. His father was a jurist and had converted from whatever he was prior. I don't think he was a practicing Jew, but nevertheless was baptized and had his family baptized and brought up in the state church in that area of Germany, which was Lutheran. Marx himself, as a young man, as an adolescent, I guess is most properly the case, apparently demonstrated some proclivities in the area of theology. His high school graduation, I don't think thesis is the right word, but presentation was an exposition of some material in the Gospel according to John, if you find a collection of Marx's works that still is extant and published. Out of that background, I'll give you a biographical footnote. For those of you who are interested in such things as, not a biographical footnote, a bibliographical footnote, for those of you who are interested in intellectual history, there's an unbelievably fascinating book by an American scholar, John Murray Cudahy. And the title of the book is The Ordeal of Civility. And the book is about three great Jewish critical thinkers of the late 19th and early 20th century, Marx, Freud, and Claude Lévi-Strauss, the sociologist. And what Cudahy has done in this book is to say that what's really going on with these three characters is the contest between Jewishness and the acculturation of Western civilization. That for Cudahy, what it means to be Jewish is to have a kind of raw and anguished cry about injustice and pain in the human community. That civility is the attempt to muffle that pain and outrage in the interest of some kind of social order. And that's the struggle that Jews had to deal with in their acculturation in Western society, and that how difficult that struggle for civility is. The ordeal of civility gives away his thesis in a lot of ways, is that that's manifest in Marx in the area of political economy, Freud in the area of psychology, and Claude Lévi-Strauss in the analysis of society. So if you're interested in the history of ideas, a really fascinating book to read. But in some ways, Marx at least is an acculturated Jew, a Jew having been baptized and brought into Western society. He was university trained. He started out at the University of Bonn under his father's influence, studying law. He apparently was a better student at that time than he was an academician. That is to say, his primary curriculum was Ein, zwei, drei, vier, lift your stein and drink your beer, rather than anything else. And then after a while of that, he migrated, as German students, particularly in the 19th century, were inclined to do, to Berlin, where he took up the study of philosophy and encountered the great German philosopher Hegel, although not directly, but through Hegel's students. And then finally he went and presented a dissertation for his doctorate at the university in Jena, and presented and defended a dissertation on some obscure piece of ancient Greek philosophy. In spite of this, Marx never was a professor. In terms of his career, he spent some time as a journalist writing for a couple of German and French radical magazines, both of which were very short-lived, closed down by the state for their radicalism. And for most of his life, he spent it in exile in London, sitting every day in the British Museum, writing, thinking, reading. His two major sources of income for his life were, first of all, his collaborator and great fan, Friedrich Engels, who provided him with some money. Those of you interested in the ironies of life will know that Engels, who is to some degree the co-founder of Marxian socialism with Marx, spent his whole life as a practicing capitalist, running a sweatshop for his uncle in Manchester, and that was one source of Marx's income. And the other source of Marx's income was Horace Greeley, the American newspaper man. I don't know whether that was before or after his advice to go west, but in any event, he employed Marx as a European correspondent for his New York Tribune. Marx spoke and wrote in the context of working class movements in Europe, but he was never a laborer, and he was never a labor organizer. Marx was married, he had a family, he saw two of his children die because of the fact that he did not have money available to buy medicine to deal with them in childhood illnesses. So much for biography. Now, let me just say a couple of preliminary items. First of all, Marx had a very strong moral sense, and he understood his work as being a kind of struggle and fight for justice. In spite of that, it's really wrong to see him as primarily a moralist or a prophet calling for better treatment of poor folks. What he intended to do was to be a critical observer and analyst describing how things actually went in the world. Now, as a corollary to that, it's important to see that Marx analyzed capitalism, far and away the predominant quantity of writing of Marx is analysis of capitalism. If there's a proposal of socialism in Marx, quantitatively that's a very minor item, and it's also very kind of vague and amorphous. It's not well spelled out as a system. I think we need to understand that. What that means is that socialist societies may be able to, current day so-called socialist societies, may be able to claim Marx as a kind of analytical base, but they sure can't claim him very clearly as a kind of a predictive or prescriptive character. To be sure, when Marx analyzed capitalism and made the limited proposals of socialism that he did, there were consequences in terms of the distribution of wealth in that analysis. But primarily, Marx was interested in analyzing capitalism as a mode of production. Marx was interested fundamentally in the process of production, not the end result of distribution, although those consequences were there. In Marx's time, there were other socialisms rampant throughout Europe that dealt with things from the angle of the distribution of wealth. Marx's word for them was utopian, and that's not a good term. What he meant by that was that these utopian socialisms that talked about how we could make things better by redistributing wealth were naive because they didn't pay attention at all to the nature of the productive process under capitalism, which required things to be as they were on the distribution end. And I'm afraid that Marx would call most of us, particularly Christians, who are involved in peace and justice issues from moral standpoints, utopians today. He would claim that we are naive, whether we were talking about just distribution of wealth or war and peace issues. He'd say we were naive, that we just didn't understand what it was about the system, the capitalist system that required things to be the way they are in terms of the war and peace and justice issues. Finally, a disclaimer, and then I'll try to get to Marx's concept. I will obviously not deal here with all of Marx. That would be really atrocious to try that. You know, I mean, Capital is so thick. And besides, I'm a five-time loser in trying to read that book. That's a very hard thing to read. So I will not do all of Marx, but what seemed to me to be some key concepts that, on the one hand, allow us to see what Marx was about in his analysis, and on the other hand, that lead to some significance for Christians. Even on that score, I will be selective. In preparing to put this together, my biggest struggle was always with what is it that I can responsibly eliminate. And therefore, there may be two results from that. One is that I may end up having a much more systematized and schematized Marx than Marx's own writings warrant. And on the other hand, it may be really quite disconnected to you as listeners because these things are consciously topical. And while their connections make sense to me, that doesn't guarantee that they will for you. Okay, enough of that stuff. Some key elements in Marx. The starting point for Marx is his observation that the world of human beings is a world of value. That is, that people actually exchange goods and services. The world is, for Marx, a vast marketplace. And moreover, this exchange is not simply arbitrary. but it appears to manifest certain relationships among the items that are exchanged. For instance, apart from the fact that I had a super amount of force over against you, you would never exchange your tractor for my loaf of bread. Right? I mean, unless I could extort that from you. So that the relationships aren't arbitrary, but they seem to manifest certain fixed relationships among the exchangeable items. As Marx pursues that, he comes to the conclusion that value, the concept of value, really has two parts to it. On the one hand, there is what Marx calls use value, that is, what something can actually be used for, and exchange value, that is, the relationship of exchange between items. Now, some things, Marx observes, have use value but no exchange value. For example, air and sunlight. I mean, air is obviously quite useful to human species, but as of this point, nobody's been able to package it and market it in Woolworths, Kresge's, or wherever the case may be. Or sunlight, or something like that, although the energy companies are doing better in the sunlight department in terms of packaging it. But he says, if some items have use value but no exchange value, we ought to presume that all items that are exchanged have some kind of use value, presumably. But the only thing is that having said that, the question becomes, how is exchange value arrived at? And he says that finally, after you boil everything down, that the exchange value of any item is the embodiment in that product of the quantity of human labor required to produce or reproduce the product. Now, Marx understood that people worked at different rates, and so he, like all economists, said, we're dealing with average human labor at this point. But nevertheless, the exchange value of any item is the quantity of human labor required to produce or reproduce that product. Now, up to that point, Marx got all of that notion from his reading of the classical capitalist economists, Adam Smith, and even more notably than that, David Ricardo. But what Marx did was to take this, and it was called at the time the labor theory of value, took this labor theory of value and pressed it to a couple of conclusions. First, in terms of anything worth talking about in the area of exchange, it was human labor that was the sole producer of value. That other things were valuable is not to be denied. But all the other valuable items are not subject to exchange. When you're talking about the exchange of items, it's only human labor that produces value. Therefore, for Marx, human nature was essentially creative. Human nature interacted with the material world to create the valuable human world. This concept Marx called praxis. Okay? You may have, in any kind of sort of with it conversation these days, have heard the term praxis thrown around all over the place. Most people, as I hear them use it as if it were just sort of a kind of a precious or precocious synonym for practice. You know, we got to get out of theory and we got to put our theory into praxis or something like that. Well, not for Marx. For Marx, it is not a synonym for practice. For Marx, praxis is the term for the world-creating dynamic interplay between human labor and the material world. Keep that in mind. That's an important item for later. Second, this is also the essence of Marx's much-touted materialism. Marx distinguished between what he called the crass belly materialism of the capitalists, that is, a materialism based on accumulation, consumption, and possession, and his own, what came to be called, dialectical materialism, which for Marx simply meant the creative interaction of the human species and the material world to produce what is valuable. Third, Marx observed that there's a strange impact of efficiency on the product of human labor. Human labor, he observed, is always becoming more efficient. People become better and better at what they're doing, more efficient at it, and that the net effect of this was that it had a devaluing effect on the product of human labor. So, for example, if a unit of human labor, that is to say, human work calculated in time, let's make one up, 200 hours, I don't know, 200 hours can produce one tractor, then the exchange value of the tractor is that unit of human labor. In other words, you ought to be able to exchange that tractor under normal circumstances for 200 hours worth of bread to keep my bread tractor business going. Okay? But if under the impact of efficiency, that same unit of human labor, 200 hours, now produces two tractors, each of those tractors can only be exchanged for 100 hours worth of bread. Huh? So that there's a devaluing effect of the product out of efficiency. Now for Marx, that turns out to be not just a kind of a so what, but will have a terrific impact in a few moments when we observe how human labor itself gets paid. Okay, that's a terrifically important item. Okay, so there's the first key concept, the labor theory of value. Next key concept for me is commodity. Obviously, if there is going to be exchange, there must be something to be exchanged. And that means that human beings must produce surplus. To put it at a kind of primitive stage, as long as my labor can only gather enough berries for me to consume each day to stay alive, there will be no exchange. It's only after I get very efficient as a berry producer, as a berry gatherer, and can gather more than I can consume, that I have a product to exchange with somebody else. That's surplus product, and when that surplus product is organized for exchange, when the production process is oriented towards producing surplus for exchange, it becomes a commodity. That item becomes a commodity. Now, under this commodity, this notion of commodity, two things come to light. First of all, no longer are commodities exchanged directly. One commodity has come to function as the medium of exchange among all commodities, namely money. Now, Marx, in Capital, has a very fascinating analysis of how precious metals come to be the fundamental money. He says that the fact is that in order for something to serve as the medium of exchange, it's got to have three things going for it. First of all, it's got to be small enough to be able to carry around. Half of buckskin is not going to be a very convenient medium of exchange because it's hard to move down the lake and stuff like that. On the other hand, that very small item has got to be able to embody in itself a large quantity of human labor, if the labor theory of value is true. And that, of course, is true of the whole mining, smelting process of precious metals. And the third thing, of course, is that it's got to be an item, a commodity that's rare enough so that you just can't go pick it up all over the place. So those are the three items, and he sees precious metals as fulfilling that. What's most interesting about this analysis of the way in which precious metals, money, come to be the commodity of commodities is that he says they become, at that point, the real arbiter of value, so that now, for example, we do not anymore talk about the labor time of any product. We calculate its worth in terms of dollars and cents, or yen, or rubles, or pounds, or marks, or whatever the currency may be. The currency itself becomes the arbiter of value, the determiner of worth, What's most interesting about that discussion is that when Marx engages in that discussion in Capital, he retreats to the biblical language about mammon and does all of that conversation in terms of money as the god mammon taking over human life. Very fascinating discussion. That's point one. One commodity becomes the arbitrator of worth. Secondly, Marx observes that in this framework, human labor itself has now become a commodity. No longer do you have actual creative human labor applied to the world, but now you have an abstraction, simply available labor power that the worker can sell on the market to an employee or to an employer. In other words, what the laborer sells is 8 hours of their time in the shop, on the job, wherever that may be. Labor has now become a commodity. Marx asks how that came about, and what he arrives at as his conclusion is something like this. Human labor becomes active only through means of production, that is, things like land and capital, implements, facilities, and the like. And workers no longer have direct access to them on their own. The means of production are now under the control of a minority of people, even though the means of production are themselves the product of human labor. Now, it's not obviously not time to review Marx's history of all this, but it's important to see that he saw this end result as the end result of a history, and indeed a history that was a violence-filled history and not some kind of law of the Medes and the Persians dumped down from heaven. In other words, capitalism, this organization of human labor in which some people control the means of production and others have only their raw labor power to offer, is the end result of a historical product, of a historical process. Okay. Now, this situation of the commoditization of labor resulted in what Marx called alienation. It's important to understand that for Marx, alienation is not a psychological term referring to our feelings or our mood about anything. We tend to say, you know, if you feel alienated, then you're alienated, but if you don't, you're not. Marx would say, if you don't feel alienated, then you are most alienated, because you've been so severed from your own creative humanity that you can't even recognize it anymore to moan over it. You know? So the most alienated are those who don't realize it. It's an objective term, not a psychological term. And what it refers to objectively is two items. First of all, it refers to the fact that workers do not have control over their own labor in the production process. In other words, workers at Rockwell, Boeing, or Merck Sharp & Dohme do not make the decisions about what their labor will produce. They offer only the abstraction of labor power, and somebody else tells them what they will do with it. Therefore, they are alienated. It refers equally to the non-control of the product of human labor. What happens to the product of human labor, Marx asks. He says that what happens is this. Part of it is returned to the laborer as wage. How much? An increasingly small proportion, says Marx. Even if wages rise in terms of absolute dollars and cents, Marx says, an increasingly small proportion of the product of labor is returned to the laborer. Why? Because wages are the price of labor. And a price, says Marx, always tends, it never may be exactly equals, but it always tends in the direction of the actual exchange value of a product. But what is the exchange value of a product? It's the cost required in human labor terms to produce or reproduce that item. In other words, in terms of the laborer situation, The wage is always going to be however much is necessary to have that person back working the next day. There are obviously some physical things. The person can't die from lack of food, can't die from exposure, can't die from non-shelter. There maybe are some psychological things that are involved in that. But in any event, the wage will always be the price required, the exchange value required to get the worker to reproduce their labor. And under the impact of efficiency, the worker will always be turning out that much product in increasingly less time. So if, for example, at one point in the work process, in order to get enough to keep themselves going, it requires 4 hours of labor, and the laborer works 8 hours, then the laborer works 4 hours for themselves, 4 hours for the capitalist. If under the efficiency, the impact of efficiency, the labor can produce enough product for them to replicate themselves in 1 hour, then they work 1 hour for themselves and 8 hours for the capitalist. Because the wage will always tend to reach that point in which exchange value is real. Okay. So that becomes a very significant item also for Marx. Now this situation is the basis for Marx's description of the phenomenon of class under capitalism. Marx didn't invent classes. He didn't discover classes. People had observed and talked about classes well before the time of Marx. What Marx tried to do was to observe what happened to class strata under the impact of capitalism. And what he observed was that there was a movement in the direction of two classes, capitalist and proletariat. That is, those who controlled the means of production and those who had only their labor power to offer. Marx realized that there were all kinds of internal complexities, that land capital and industrial capital and finance capital struggled with each other for positions of dominance, that within the proletariat there was the group that he called the lumpen proletariat, those who were already so demoralized in a quite literal sense, demoralized as to have been just simply bought out by the capitalists and have offering no resistance whatsoever. But the objective situation of who controls the means of production and who doesn't is what determines class for Marx. Now in this situation, Marx did not believe that one class was alienated and the other class wasn't. Both classes were alienated, capitalist and proletariat. That doesn't make them the same. There's a big difference because the proletariat experienced alienation as oppression, the capitalist experienced alienation as domination, and that's a big difference for Marx. The obvious corollary to the concept of class is the concept of class struggle. Marx perceives that history proceeds through the social conflict of interest groups. Nobility against peasantry, town citizens against the nobility, traditional landed gentry over against commercial, financial, industrial groups, and so on. In this struggle, Marx sees the apparatus of the state as the instrument of those already holding power, and it's an instrument of violence in the struggle against those who are a threat to the power holders. Okay. Marx, by the way, did not think there would be a human world, a human society, with no governance. He was not an anarchist. But he did not equate state and governance. The state, if you will, is governance under the impact of class struggle, governance in the hands of the ruling class. For Marx, the culmination of class struggle is the conflict between the proletariat and the capitalist class, because the proletariat represents all other classes in history. To some degree, that means the very simple matter that all other classes in prior history just by virtue of the fact that they've been perpetually excluded. I mean, in other words, here's a little group of peasant farmers who get foreclosed on and they're kicked off into the city. That class of peasant farmers is now manifest as the proletariat. That's the end result of it. To some degree, he means that. To some degree, he means the very sophisticated kind of analysis that says that the proletariat even represents the capitalists, humanly speaking, because they are the obverse of the capitalist superhumanity. Capitalist superhumanity has as its opposite side oppression among the proletariat. In the context of class struggle, Marx talks about ideology. The systems of human thinking and reflection on life in the world. Hegel, in some sense Marx's intellectual ancestor, had seen history as the result of ideas in conflict. That's Hegel's great idea. What history is all about is that ideas meet and bounce off one another and struggle with one another and come to some kind of embodiment, popular notion. Marx, on the other hand, saw ideas as the result of the history of conflict. He turns it around. The ruling ideas, Marx said, were always the ideas of the rulers. That's just the kind of spelling out of the old notion that history is always written by the winners, right? So you only get a one-sided picture of things. So the ruling ideas are the ideas of the rulers, and these ideas, for Marx, flow out of the relationship between ruler and rule. In other words, there's no neutral starting point for thinking, but only our concrete human relationships, social relationships among human beings. No neutral ground. From that vantage point, we can understand Marx's much-touted atheism and his critique of religion. Two initial items. First, there was atheism before Marx. Marx did not invent atheism. Most of that atheism was very philosophical, very abstract, very speculative, and Marx thought that it was mostly superficial and pointless. Second, Marx took religion far more seriously than most religious people do. Most religious people are quite content to make religion one compartment of their life, one item on their value agenda among many. For Marx, the critique of religion is the foundation, the basis of all critique. That is, for Marx, if you want to understand and penetrate into what's going on in actual human social life, you start with the critique of religion. And under this impact, Marx says two things. First, he says, religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. That is, people are religious. They yearn for salvation, they reach for eternity, or however you want to put it, because of the brokenness of their actual lives in the world. In other words, religion for Marx is a symptom of a real distress in human life. And I would suggest that anybody, before rejecting Marx out of hand, should check that out about their own religion personally and about the way religion operates in the society around them. Second, and this is the most famous and familiar of Marx's statements, he says, religion is the opiate of the masses. And what he means by that is that although religion expresses a real pain, religion is used at the same time by the ruling class as a kind of narcotic to keep people immobilized. By promising solutions beyond and outside of this world, people can be psychologically put at ease with their real social situation in this world. And if you need an example of that, the most obvious one is the example of the religion that American slaveholders taught to American slaves. They interpreted black slavery as being the result of black sin. The reason black people were enslaved because they were sinners. And The way in which that could be overcome was by being good and obedient to their masters in their servitude. Blacks would receive a heavenly reward after they died. That was the intention. How well that worked, by the way, or perhaps better, how well that didn't work, if you're interested in that terrific book called Roll, Jordan, Roll, by Eugene Genovese, who's a Marxist historian of American history, in which he analyzes the slave society in the United States and deals with the religious question there. Terrific book. Now, beyond these two items, Marx's atheism is a result of his concept of praxis. Okay. Praxis, remember, is Marx's word for human self-creation. And pay attention to the fact that that's not atomized or individualized, but socialized. Marx would never say that I created the world of value, but that we, together, created the world of value. Okay? So, if that's true, that in praxis, human beings create the valuable world, then for Marx, the notion of an active creator God must go. It's a simple logical step for him. There can't be two creators of value. Now, I think we need to pay attention to the fact that most current-day religious creationism, for example, in its arguments about how long ago God created the universe, by what process, are as atheistic as Marx, only without knowing it. They locate creation sometime in the past. Marx at least understood that the doctrine of creation was about the value of our human life here and now, and tried to struggle with that under the concept of praxis. Okay, two final items. First, Marx's analysis is an analysis of systems and not personal morality. The problem, therefore, is not this or that particular capitalist in their personal niceness or nastiness. The problem for Marx is capitalism, a mode of production, a way of organizing human life and labor, a set of arrangements, social arrangements and relationships. And therefore, Marx is a thoroughgoing anti-reformist. Marx has no notion at all that you can somehow or another fix capitalism up by getting the right people in the right leadership places, which is the common liberal idea, right? Marx is anti-liberal, virulent anti-liberal. You know, liberals always say, geez, if we only got the right guy to be president or the right person to be head of General Motors, then it would be okay. Marx said, that's crazy. The system works according to a logic. And it makes no difference who the bosses are. The system carries out its own logic to change, produces its own undoing. Capitalism produces its own undoing. He says it creates its own grave diggers. And what he means by that is that capitalism as a system is based upon the value of the accumulation of capital, the profit motive. That's its inherent logic. But such accumulation doesn't happen in abstract. It happens in a set of relationships. And so the flip side of one person's capital accumulation is another person's capital impoverishment. Okay? You can't have everybody accumulating. It's not a possibility. And as capital concentrates, then what happens is that more and more people come about who have no vested interest in that system anymore. The proletariat pace, the proletariatizing of life goes on, and you build up an ever large group of people who just simply have no vested interest in maintaining that system. So it contained its own contradiction. Or we could point to the contradiction between saving and consuming. Capitalism needs to have the workers consume the product, but at the same time, it inculcates an ethic of saving because it needs to accumulate capital, and at the very same time is giving less and less of the product to the laborer. So while it needs workers to consume, it gives people less and less to consume with and encourages them to save at the same time. That's a contradiction. Marx said that contradiction explains the terrific chaos, he called it anarchy, of the business cycle under capitalism, why you have such things as depression or recession and then inflation and overproduction and underproduction. And he thought that contradiction explained it. Or you could talk about the value, the conceptual value between the value of work on the one hand and the need of capitalism to maintain an army of unemployed people so as to have a cheap labor supply, so that there would be a competitive labor market. Nobody could say to the capitalist, I'm going to work for you for those wages anymore, I'll go out and get another job. The capitalist instead says, if you don't like my wages, go be unemployed, because there's somebody ready to replace you. But the focal contradiction of Marx is far more fundamental than that. He sees the fundamental contradiction in capitalism as lying in the gap between the private ownership of the means of production and the fact that capitalism has socialized work. Under capitalism, control resides in the individual entrepreneur, or later the corporate structure. But in order to produce at all, capitalism requires a socially organized and cooperative labor force. And he sees those as a fundamental contradiction. The day of the craft and the guild society is gone, and they were gone by Marx's time. The craft shop had yielded to the factory. And Marx saw, under the impact of observing the factory, that there were two divisions of labor in human history. First, what he called the social division of labor, which for him was greatly humanizing and advancing of human life. That happens where you focus your attention on building shelters, and you focus yours on making pots, and you focus yours on agricultural products, and somebody else focuses theirs on whatever the other item is. Those processes are all holistic in themselves. They require each of us to use our mind, our physical labor, our ingenuity, and so on, and become very efficient at producing real goods and services. On the other hand, Marx observed that under the impact of the factory system, we had a detailed division of labor. That is, any given work process was broken down into its component parts, so that you did the mental work, and you drew the plans, and you put this piece of machine item together, and you put that together, and you assemble the whole thing, so that no one person produces anything anymore, but the product of labor is now a collective product that requires our cooperation throughout. Marx was not sure whether that was good or bad. He tended to think it was more bad than good. But in any event, it required a socially cooperative process. And yet the control of the mechanism was neither social nor cooperative, but private and competitive. And that not by accident, but by the inherent logic of capitalism and its notion of accumulation of capitalism. And that, for Marx, was the contradiction that would finally be its undoing. Okay? That's where I'm going to stop for now. If there are any questions for discussion, stuff like that, please let's deal with them. Tomorrow I will pick up on the second half of that significance for Christians. And it does come out of that. Is that it? Please?
Yeah.
I would say, only by way of suggestion, the question for the tape recorder is, does Marx, after his analysis of the Industrial Revolution, describe a system that will work? I say only by suggestion, not by discrete plan. And what Marx suggested is the very simple, to put it in the simplest terms at least, is that what had happened in the bourgeois political revolution with respect to the democratization of political life be extended into the economic area. For him, socialism is economic democracy. By the way, Marx has very, very positive words to say about the American democracy of the 19th century. Marx is not somehow or another an anti-American, although he understood Britain and America to be the apex of the capitalist system. But Marx never thought that somehow or another you could jump from feudal society to socialism. He understood that there was historical process going on, and he understood the connection between bourgeois political democracy and economic capitalism, and what he was looking for was a movement beyond that which would extend democratic control to the industrial process itself. I suspect two things, and it's obviously speculation about what Marx would think. In heaven you can ask him, and then he'll correct me. But I speculate about two things. On the one hand, I think he would say in and of themselves that's the right direction to be going. On the other hand, you need to understand that those items are set within a whole systemic structure that is still capitalistic and therefore not a final solution, but are certainly gestures in the right direction. By the way, I don't think Marx ever thought that you could somehow or another go back. History went forward. Society was now industrialized. And it was neither wise nor possible to say, let's industrialize. Marx even talked about, by the way, a primitive communism of gatherers, before anybody produced any surplus. I mean, he thought that was really barbarian and abhorrent, and nobody should aspire to that. I think he'd have very bad words to say about the communalists in American society, who try to locate a plot in Vermont and go out and be self-sufficient. I think he would say that's regressive and naive. Has always received a lot of criticism on the basis of the fact that a lot of his detailed predictions apparently didn't come true. I don't really believe those detailed predictions are all that fundamental to his analysis. I think that his fundamental thrust has probably held up. That if you take a really kind of careful look, that probably capital is more concentrated in America, in terms of control of capital, is more concentrated in American society now than it was prior to the war, Second World War, say, that it's been increasingly centralized. Probably the biggest thrust recently in that is the whole business in the competition between agribusiness and family farming in the United States, in some sense. That's been the latest push. I think that's one thrust that has held out. I think his thrust, almost by self-confession, who is it, Calvin Coolidge or something? I mean, the business of America is business, or something like that, and the increasing use of state apparatus on behalf of those in control of capital has certainly held up. And by the way, I would posit from a Marxian standpoint that you see the same thing in the Leninist societies of Eastern Europe, which have managed to substitute state bureaucratic elites for the capitalist elites in Western society, and it's quite clear that the state apparatus is entirely brought into play to protect the state bureaucracies over against the workers in those societies, and I would argue that from the very beginning. Lenin's own track record in the Soviet Revolution is exactly along those lines. Lenin always had the Bolshevik militia out crushing worker movements all over the place. Lenin made a very subtle shift, of course. Marx talked about the dictatorship of the proletariat, by which he meant in the process of revolution, the working class would take over the state apparatus for a short period of time, simply to gain control of the workplace. Lenin shifted that from the dictatorship of the proletariat to the dictatorship of the party. That's a very different concept, folks, and they ought to never be confused. And under that guise, the Soviet military has been increasingly brought into play to protect the Soviet state apparatus against its own people.
In his theory, that you should just start with this?
Yes, that's Marx. That's what I mean by Marx's thoroughgoing anti-reformism. The only possibility is the substitution of one system for another. Because the system is simply the manifestation of the logic of the system. And you change the logic, you change the system. I mean, in other words, if you say, let's reform capitalism by pulling the profit motive out, well, then it's not capitalism anymore, because what capitalism is economic life organized around the motive of profit. That's its inherent logic. So Marx says you can't reform capitalism. All you can do is have something take its place. Okay? If I were going to exercise a critique of Marx, a personal critique of Marx's system at this point, is I would say that what has become clear since Marx worked, at least to me, is that the real system that's at play in Western society is neither the capitalist nor the Leninist systems, but is in fact the technological system per se. And the reason why American capitalism and Soviet Leninism tend to look more and more like each other to any honest observer is because what has happened in both of those places is that technology, and I don't mean machines by technology, what I mean is the rationalization, the thoroughgoing rationalization of all of life, that's become the prevailing system in both of those societies. And if I was going to critique Marx, I would say that what he apparently didn't account for is the capacity of technology per se to be the determining force in a society. That's not original. I didn't invent that, by the way. If you want the originator of it, it's a French social scientist named Jacques Ellul, and the title of the book, it's a huge book, paperback, called The Technological Society. If you read it, if anybody's encouraged to read that, it's probably in the library here, I would suspect. If anybody's encouraged to read that, after you read it and go into absolute despair, the next thing you do is you run out and you get a book by Jacques Ellul called The Meaning of the City, which is an exposition of every biblical passage that contains the word city in it, which he sees that as the biblical response to technological society, and then you get your hope up again.